There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
We're exploring post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. What is it? And I think many of us in the world will automatically associate it with military, with those who've been in wars. And while that obviously is the case, there are many other things that can contribute it. So a lot of people in the world are exposed to extraordinary traumatic events, the wars, the earthquakes, crimes. And while we might associate it with the military, a lot of people may have had some from traumatic birth, witnessing an accident, and some recover in time, but for some, the trauma can take over their lives, leaving them unable to function. But do we know what this diagnosis really is? Or has it been confused with a broader term for anyone who suffered a trauma? And culturally, is it a useful diagnosis? I'm joined this afternoon in the studio by Chastity O'Connell, who's a mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Good afternoon, Chastity.
Hello, Helen. Thanks for having
me. Happy UAE Mother's Day.
Thank you. Same to you.
I'm hoping I'm going to get some kind of poorly made card when I get home this afternoon.
How about artistic, creative, outside of the box?
She's three. There's a lot of outside of the lines.
There is. Textbook outside of the box, yes.
Do you know what? We keep on getting loads of artwork sent home from nursery. And I mean, what are you supposed to do with that stuff? Serious question.
It is. I think I've heard a few moms sort of take a picture of it and then maybe put a little, you know, calendar or folder or photo book together. And then some moms might have a more selective process where...
Well, they don't let it in the house. That would be me.
It comes in and then they have a beautiful discussion about recycling.
So yes. Meaningful.
And only some make the refrigerator. So I think it's really important to start messaging early on that
the importance of editing.
Yes.
Yeah. We got a print made, actually. It was a company here that they do a scan of the art and then they turn those scans into a print. So it could be the alphabet or it could be a shape that you like or something for the nursery. And then I gleefully throw out a whole load of art. But it's all the 3D stuff that you like. I can't even like plasticine models and things like that.
Yeah, and there might be like a serving of pasta on some of them.
Some,
you know,
sequins and glitter. Yes. To really, really get all over the car.
Yeah.
So yes, happy UA Mother's Day to everyone who is celebrating this afternoon. We do have a little treat or two coming up for you in the show. So stay tuned if you fancy winning some fantastic prizes. But as we said, it's on the couch. Chastity O'Connell is here, mental health counsellor. And we're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. And my initial, as I said, impression is this affects soldiers coming home from war. Like that's my sole association until I started looking into this a little bit more deeply. And that's not the case. But to go back to basics, in layman's terms, what is post-traumatic stress disorder?
Post-traumatic stress disorder is a mental health disorder that can be triggered by a traumatic event. And that can be anything from wartime violence to interpersonal violence like assault, domestic violence, and so forth. What makes post-traumatic stress disorder specific is that it is characterized by a number of criteria or a number of experiences that make it different from other disorders. Interestingly enough, post-traumatic stress disorder, whenever people experience trauma, most of the time they will not go on to develop PTSD. And in fact, most of the time, 8 to 10% of the time, that's when PTSD will result, potentially, or has the potential to result. Let me watch what I'm saying. But the overwhelming majority of the time, people that experience trauma do not experience post-traumatic stress disorder.
And that would be because that manifests itself through, they might be able to express themselves in kind of a more effective way, or why are some people more susceptible than others then?
That's a great question. So and statistics are around 30 to 70% of people that experience trauma will go on to experience over time post-traumatic growth, PTG. And that's a big spread, 30 to 70%. And within that 30 to 70%, it depends on a number of factors that influence that influence the potential development of PTSD. And by that, it could have to do with the nature of the trauma. Is it sort of a natural disaster, or is it interpersonal? Their proximity to the trauma. It could also have to do with things like social support and whether or not they've experienced past trauma. So if it's repeated trauma, then that does increase the likelihood of experiencing PTSD.
That's exactly what I was going to ask. In terms of intensity, a one-off event could be as impactful as repeated, or is repeated generally you're more susceptible?
It depends, but with repeated events, that tends to increase the likelihood of developing PTSD. At the same time, when people experience interpersonal violence, they're much more likely to develop major depressive disorder than they are PTSD. So there's a lot to think about when we're unpacking trauma. And one of the things that I think is getting a lot of attention, and rightly so, is complex developmental trauma. So that's relating
to
that is relating to children who experience severe abuse and neglect, where it's not one big massive trauma, but a prolonged exposure to many traumas or adverse life circumstances.
So their life has become traumatic.
Yes.
On an ongoing
basis. Chaotic, you can neglectful, abusive. Yes.
I'm glad you raised the point of children there, because I think the myth is, you know, children are resilient, children bounce back. Mm-hmm. Can children get post-traumatic stress disorder?
They can. And the way it would manifest is potentially different than it does in adults. So they can. We don't want to oversell a child's resilience. It depends. Thankfully, the presentation of PTSD, there's a lot of factors that are involved. And again, relating to things like interventions, family support, at what age the trauma happened to the child, and how they were coping before, what was their level of functioning pre-trauma, what is their level of functioning after trauma. So there's all sorts of factors, which is good. It means that there's it isn't a plus b equals c. It isn't you've experienced trauma, you will now have PTSD. So I think that's a good message.
So symptoms, what should we be looking for in ourselves or in loved ones and those around us if we've got concerns about PTSD?
So the biggest symptom, I would say, that's the defining feature of PTSD is the presence of intrusive memories. And this is kind of that they're re-experiencing the
trauma. So it's like you're there again.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there are, for example, let's say if someone was exposed to conflict within a country and they're now in another country that's a safe place for them, they might be walking down the grocery aisle, completely, sort of just in the moment looking for ketchup or what have you, and see something that might trigger that memory from what happened to them. And all of a sudden, they're there again. It is if that event is happening to them in the moment. And that is incredibly distressing, because there's an element of not knowing when it's going to happen. And also the fact that physiologically your body is responding as if that threat is right in front of you. So that's one of the key features of PTSD.
I think the word intrusive is so important there.
Yes, absolutely.
That it's taking over. You're not in control. You're not sitting down and choosing to look back at something. It's invading your thoughts and your very being. Mm-hmm. And often, of course, unwelcome thoughts.
Absolutely. You put it beautifully, actually, that there is... the degree of control, degree of unwantedness is so painful.
What about nightmares?
Nightmares are definitely part of it. So it's this invasion of daytime existence and nighttime sleep. So it's particularly cruel.
Now, people, I think the instincts of a human being would be to try and get out of the situation that they were in, but also emotionally avoid feeling like that again. Mm-hmm. What about avoidance? Does that help? Mm. Or is avoidance a symptom and part of it?
Oh, you brought up one of, again, the when we're looking at PTSD avoidance, you can't talk about PTSD without talking about avoidance. And so gradually what you'll find with people who experience PTSD is that their world becomes progressively smaller and smaller. So if we go back to the grocery store example, you have the person re-experiencing that traumatic event in the moment. And there is a powerlessness that comes from that. And if you feel that way, over time, you may start to associate that intrusive memory with that place. And so it may be really difficult for you to go there to the point where you avoid that place. And gradually, because you don't know when, you don't know how, your world becomes smaller and smaller. So in fact, it's some of those sort of simple principles from classical conditioning, where you just have this involuntary response, this intense fear, anxious anxiety response in these situations, and that gets that response that you have, that bodily reaction gets associated with that place. And so over time, is it the grocery store, or was it that you were in your car? Was it the car, or was it that you left the house? Was it the front, or what was it that you left the front door? You know, and then before you know it, your world becomes a lot smaller.
What about avoidance in the sense of self-medicating with over the counter or alcohol? Is that something that can follow on?
You are amazing.
Oh, thanks.
You literally are going through, issue or factor by factor when it comes to post-traumatic stress disorder. Substance abuse is highly correlated with PTSD, and that is because of the memories, the intrusive memories, the feeling. You find people self-medicating with alcohol or other substances in order to temporarily be free from whatever it is that, but it doesn't work in the long term.
So the numbing is very much a short term.
Absolutely.
I'm joined in the studio this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell, who's a mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Chastity, what's your favourite cake?
Ooh.
Come on, quick fire round.
Red velvet, but if it's homemade, then just simple yellow butter cake with chocolate frosting.
Sounds good. Hopefully that's inspired you this afternoon. So send in your favourite cake and your name, 4001, on the Dubai Eye Messenger app to win a 500 dirham voucher to spend at Sal Sucre Patisserie. Now, we talked earlier about some of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. We've talked about intrusive memories, about avoidance, about numbness and self-medicating. What other things should we be aware of, Chastity?
Two of the other major features of PTSD. One is the experience of heightened arousal. So experiencing the racing heart, the sweating, what the body is going through as if it were under threat. So there's that actual physical experience of PTSD. And then there's how it affects our cognitions, how it affects the way we think, and leading to thoughts maybe related to things like paranoia, irrational fears, and in some ways disorganized thinking. So it really depends on, of course, the severity of PTSD, but there's a number of factors or a number of symptoms affecting both body and mind.
Someone is asking, when talking about avoidance, how does this differ to a diagnosis of an anxiety disorder, for example, agoraphobia?
So the main difference is that whether or not trauma is present. So with agoraphobia, you may be experiencing the symptoms, you may perceive the threat as real, but it's not in relationship to trauma. Whereas you can experience agoraphobia as part of PTSD as well. So it can be a feature of PTSD.
Okay. When should people be worried? Because obviously, let's say for example, you witnessed an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And that stayed with you, and you are having flashbacks over the course of a few days. When should you get worried? When do you feel like you're not coping with that incident in a way on your own? Mm. Should it be days, weeks, months? When should you get in touch with someone who can help?
When you're talking about things like trauma, and because there is such wide variability with how people recover from trauma, you're looking at that first, 3 months or so where people are trying to rally their own internal coping skills in order to make sense of what happened. And that's an important part of the process. So if someone experiences trauma, and then a week later, someone's like, you need to deal with this, you need to deal with this, that can be actually unhelpful. So it's really important to allow people that space to process the trauma. It's only when you start seeing severe impairments in functioning, are restricted in life activities, and of course the presence of those very severe intrusive memories and re-experiencing, that you can start thinking about post-traumatic stress disorder. But there are examples of different traumatic events that have happened where people have come in and tried to provide therapy shortly thereafter. And you know, when people experience a trauma, there's something about the body using, like, just numbing, where the denial that it happened can allow the mind time in order to deal with it in a way that is helpful, rather than trying to confront everything all at once.
This is anonymous. It says, thanks for talking about this. My husband served in Afghanistan and during the day seems fine. Enjoys his job, goes out with his friends, but he suffers from nightmares and even jumps out of bed in his sleep as if he's going to attack something. He's never been violent towards me in his sleep, but I'm worried that he hasn't really dealt with what he went through. Could he have post-traumatic stress disorder?
So in this case, I appreciate you raising the issue of this re-experiencing in dreams and how actions in dreams can take on quite an active presentation. So I would say, the thing to bear in mind, PTSD is, it can range in severity. And if you have concerns, particularly if it's related to things like sleep, because we know quality of sleep can also affect our psychological well-being, it cannot hurt to seek guidance from a professional to just get a more comprehensive look at what is going on. Is this really not impacting work, or is the, you know, challenges with sleeping, for example, the waking up, is that somehow, is there something that can be done to increase or enhance the quality of life?
Okay, I really hope that does help. I also hope that you're able to talk to him about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because maybe he's not even aware of what he's doing at night.
That would be, I think, with the person who asked the question, there was an assumption on my part, and wrongly so, that they had spoken with the husband about it. So Helen bringing that up is a great place to start.
Okay, we've have quite a few messages coming in now. Ben is asking, if someone's had a traumatic experience, should one talk about it with the victim or avoid the conversation? So really, that's asking, as a friend, as someone in the family, how can you help someone who's gone through an experience that might be traumatic?
So with this one, so if someone is experiencing, has experienced a traumatic experience, basically it's just letting them know that you're there and that they can talk to you. And if they need help, maybe looking at resources, but there is this, depending on how long ago in the past the trauma happened, sometimes people don't know how to cope with it themselves, and they're figuring this out, because trauma is, you know, depending on how it impacts you, it can bring up questions of a much more existential nature, and things like, if this happened to me, is the world a safe place that I thought, or what does this mean about me, and how am I going to include this or incorporate this into my narrative now? So that takes time for the people that are that have experienced the trauma.
Yeah, they possibly don't even know how to talk to themselves about what happened, never mind somebody else.
Absolutely. And so I would keep that 2 to 3 month time period in mind, and just letting them know, not trying to push too hard, and that you need to talk about this. I can't believe you're dealing with this, or you're not dealing with this. I think that can be very difficult on the person who's experienced the trauma. But it really is just letting them know that they're there, and you're ready to listen. Okay. And connect them with resources in the community.
Follow-up question here to earlier about anxiety disorders such as agoraphobia, saying, thanks for asking my question. I agree, allow space to process. How late can PTSD show? I understand there can be a delayed response, but what kind of time frame could there be? Example, could it be even 10 years later?
So because everybody is so different, I think anytime there's a concern and impairments in functioning, as well as reduced psychological well-being, it's worth checking in with a professional. And it sounds like from your question that, you know, there is some concern there. And, you know, is it PTSD or is it major depressive disorder? You know, in a lot of ways, it's important to diagnose and make the distinction between the two. At the same time, you know, what I think the question, what I sort of understand the question to be is that I'm concerned about this person. Yes, it happened 10 years ago. Can people still experience that? And I would say absolutely, absolutely. So,
okay, I hope that helps. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the important topic of traumatic birth and how more people might be affected than this. Than we reckon. Now, I'm joined in the studio this afternoon for On the Couch by Chastity O'Connell. She's the mental health counsellor at Human Relations Institute and Clinic. We're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder this afternoon, and anyone can get post-traumatic stress disorder at any age. This includes war veterans, survivors of physical or sexual assault, abuse, accidents, disasters, and many other traumatic events. Not everyone with post-traumatic stress disorder has been through a dangerous event. Some might get it after a friend or family has experienced danger or harm, or there's been a sudden or unexpected death of a loved one. We have had a text on this subject, Chastity. So let me read you out this text. Anonymous message, and as you know, you can remain anonymous if you prefer. Saying, I had a very difficult birth with my son 3 years ago. I lost a lot of blood and I didn't get to meet him for several days. Thankfully, he was fine. I'm pregnant now, due in September. What should I should be enjoying this time, but I'm constantly distracted by thoughts of what the birth might be like and even getting flashbacks to my first. How can I get over my fears?
I think I want to first commend you for being aware and reaching out to address this issue, because I think what you're talking about affects so many women.
I've had friends, very similar situations, very similar, and being afraid to get pregnant and being truly fearful of giving birth and not feeling like they're capable of giving birth if they've had a C-section because they hadn't in their mind had the birth that they wanted. Mm-hmm. So grieving in some way for an experience that they feel was taken away from them.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds like it was a very dangerous situation. She says she lost a lot of blood and wasn't able to meet him for a couple of days. And, you know, thankfully, the baby was fine.
Mm-hmm.
How, over these coming months, could she be coming to terms with what happened and making her peace with that and then being able to deliver safely?
I would say definitely reach out to a professional. And part of this can help you prepare for the birth experience and can also enhance. We know that traumatic births can impact bonding with the baby. They can also impact the sort of experience around the birth itself, being able to advocate for yourself when you're in the delivery room. I think that comes up oftentimes for a lot of women. One of my colleagues, Dr. Diana, she's phenomenal on this issue and, you know, really looking at traumatic birth experiences and how to help women overcome those, particularly on subsequent pregnancies. So seeking a professional to work through this and address those fears, certainly support with other women and being very open and communicative with your healthcare provider. I think that's an important place to start as well.
Okay, and now we can hear from Hannah, who's this mum of two who had an emergency C-section for her firstborn, and she was later diagnosed with PTSD. Here she is.
My flashback's involuntary. It takes over like that. You're in it. You're not looking back on an experience. It's not like a memory. It's you're in it. You're reliving it. You are experiencing all those emotions again, all that fear again. You are completely there.
I was contracting very quickly and very fiercely. There were lots of panicking people around me. Marley's heart rate then plummeted, and I was rushed in for an emergency C-section. But by the time they'd got me in, his head was ready to come out. And because of that, he was a forceps delivery. I was cut without any real pain relief, which was horrible. And then Marley was born. Unfortunately, Marley's heart had stopped at that point. So I went from a screaming room of people to deadly silence. It was just so scary because you go from all that noise to complete silence. And I was asking what they were doing and no one was talking to me. No one would answer me. So the panic rises in you then as well. everything you were waiting for, everything you were planning for, this beautiful bundle that's meant to be given to you straight away. And it's, you know, I didn't even see him.
Got it!
Anything could really trigger it, to be honest, certainly in the early days. Anything where I felt unsafe seemed to trigger it. So even the thought of driving initially. And anyone asking, you know, people do ask you how it went, and that would always be a trigger, which was difficult. Because in the end, you finally stop talking about it, actually, and just shut down.
Happy birthday to you.
Their birthdays are never easy, unfortunately. For me, it's a reminder of what I had to go through to get them here. You're dragged back there every year. It never really feels completely happy and joyous like it should.
Gonna blow it out.
I feel selfish for even saying that, because it's their birthday and it's meant to be about them. So yeah, that's hard. I don't think there's any understanding of postnatal PTSD. Most people assume that that's just what soldiers get and that's it. Antidepressants kept being offered, and it's, you don't want to take antidepressants because you know it's not depression, it's not the same, and they need different treatments, there is different approaches to it, and there needs to be not even just an awareness, an understanding. There seems to be such a dismissive approach to it when it comes to the trauma side of it. It's very kind of, well, you've had a baby, what do you expect? I don't feel I was the mum I could have been. I think it did affect that, definitely. And that's very hard to look back on and not feel guilty and feel like I didn't give them my all. I didn't have it there to give, but I wish I had.
That was Hannah Freemanis, a mother of two who suffered flashbacks after the traumatic birth of her first son. Chastity O'Connell, that was very, very sad to listen to. Mm-hmm. And as you said, perhaps something that's misdiagnosed or underdiagnosed would be that post-traumatic birth that so many women go through.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you know, we think about birth being this beautiful, amazing thing. And of course, that can be the case for many, but for others, you don't get the birth you want. You're coming to terms with that fact, and you ultimately can be in a very dangerous situation with long-lasting emotional effects.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So if you've got any questions for Chastity, do get in touch. We've had one not on the subject of post-traumatic stress disorder, but the hoping you can help. Can Chastity share any advice for breaking bad habits? My daughter bites her nails and it looks awful, but I'm more worried that it's a sign of anxiety, as she does seem to do it when stressed. She's 14 and has been doing this for years. We think of nail biting as being quite a common behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
Could that link to anxiety be there?
Sure. Could it be a way that she's coping with anxiety? Certainly. It would be useful to know, you know, to what extent this nail biting is going on, because it is something that people engage in. But as far as looking at it as a symptom of anxiety, it's important to look at other pieces of the puzzle. And so the nail biting is just one very visible symptom. But I would ask questions related to sleep. What is the quality of her friendships like? What kind of, you know, what is her work like? Are there activities that she's enjoying? So it's really important, I think, sometimes, particularly when children are experiencing some kind of challenge, whether it be nail biting or bedwetting or increased tantruming, and as parents, we tend to get tunnel vision, where we only notice that thing that we do not want them doing.
That's exactly what I had this morning.
Exactly
what I had this morning with a tantruming 3-year-old.
Did you?
Oh, and I nearly lost it. But because our helper's away this month and we've got the in-laws staying with us and helping out, I had to really stand there and go, do you know what? Everything's changed for her in this last week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her kind of constant presence at home isn't there. She's got new people in the house. So of course she's acting out, but it took all of my willpower to sit down and go, do you know what? While the tantrum was, you know, hugely frustrating,
mm-hmm.
I'm very proud of myself. I managed in the heat of that moment to go, oh, she's actually just really suffering here at the moment, mm-hmm. and is struggling with dealing with this situation. But that's exactly it. You see one behaviour and can make assumptions. I mean, I just thought maybe she's overtired, but she's not. Of course she's not. She's trying to figure out what's going out at home and having, I'm using use of free counselling now, Chesty.
Oh, no, I think it's awesome that you're sharing it, especially on Mother's Day, because I do think these private battles that happen, and I use the word battle because you can maybe lose one battle but still win the war.
Let's hope so.
But these private moments of where you think, am I the only one that's going through this? Am I the only one that is driven crazy by this? And sort of what I loved about what you were saying is there is that sort of openness to understanding what she's going through, which is remarkable, particularly.
Tell you what, it was hard going. I was trying to get her in the car to go to nursery this morning when all I was like, just get in the car, you know. That, and that's what I needed her to be quick. But I think I even took 15 seconds with her and said, are you upset? Yes. Is it, you know, Ate's away? Yes. You know, and we're all in a state of flux when that routine gets thrown out of the window, but they're little people who can't communicate as well as we can.
Yeah, and that's just it. They're communicating in the only way that they know how.
Which is shrieking.
And shrieking gets our attention. I mean, it's incredibly effective. You know, they are not in the passive aggressive stages yet.
Right. Looking forward to that stage.
I know,
fantastic. Sorry, back to this text about nail biting. So she's 14, seems to be stressed. What would be your first port of call?
First port of call would be to just try and look at that behavior in context. And so see if there's other things that are leading you to think that this is a symptom of anxiety. Because yes, nail biting can be associated with nervousness, anxiousness, certainly. But at the same time, nail biting and anxiety, you know, something suggests to me that maybe you think that there's more going on. And so if that's the case, it might be worth, you know, your daughter's 14, having a chat with her, seeing, you know, what it's like at school. How does she feel like she's coping? What are the quality of her friendships are like? To the extent that you can, it might be worth even checking with the school counselor and seeing if there's, you know, something more that they might be concerned about. But it's one behavior in the context of many, and we all have little annoying habits. So it's,
of course, and I know what it's like. If you tune into one behavior, then you start noticing it all the time.
You do. You absolutely do. You get tunnel vision on it, and part of that is our own protective mode going in, that she's going to bite her nails and people are going to know she's nervous, and if people know she's nervous, then they're going to think she's not confident, and if they think she's not confident, then she's not going to, you know, be trusted to do the big projects. If she's not trusted to do the big projects, she's not going to have the stuff to put on her CV to get her application into uni. And if she can't get into uni, she's going to be living in a van in Alcoos.
Or worse, at home.
It's
understandable concerns, sure. But yeah, have a look at it in context of the bigger picture.
And I don't want to make light of it by any stretch. And so that's why I think it's important to just start, you know, expanding the vision just around what other things are going on in her life. And if it looks like there's a number of other things that are going on, there's the nail biting and she's not eating how she usually is, she's up late, she's in her phone all the time, then that might signal there's something going on.
I'm joined this afternoon by Chesty O'Connell, who's a mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. And this is your chance to get some free advice. It's your free clinic this afternoon. And you can, of course, remain completely anonymous. I've had a message that's come in on the text line saying, my five-year-old son has highly functioning autism and I've noticed he's behaving very badly, just with me, his mum, shouting all the time and having tantrums. I feel I'm not that strong and don't know how to correct him. Chastity, can you offer any advice?
Sure. With that in mind, there's a couple of things that come to mind. One is sort of looking at what could be going on. Is this a change in previous behavior? And it sounds like it is. I notice that he is behaving very bad with me. And it might be worth looking at, has anything changed in his routine? What kind of changes are going on in and around his life? Sort of like the example earlier, the extent to which you can, that you shared actually, Helen.
Of my tantruming three-year-old.
With your tantruming three-year-old.
But as you said, there are things happening at home.
Yes.
In terms that her regular routine has been pretty much thrown upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And she's acting out.
Mm-hmm. And with autism, we we know that structure and routine is really important. So if there are some changes in that area, that might help explain what might be going on. Additionally, it might be looking at to what extent this behavior is trying to communicate something. And so behavioral analysis can be extremely helpful in understanding, is there something that's going on that the child is unable to communicate on? And so in that respect, it would be helpful seeking a professional to help sort of understand and put that behavior in perspective. Because oftentimes children use tantrums to communicate. And what I would also say, and probably most importantly, mom, is, it sounds like you're going through a lot. And so my main question would be, where do you get support? How do you recharge after experiencing these tantrums? And so it might be worthwhile looking at what can you do as far as coping skills when son is having a tantrum. Is there a safe place he can be, especially if you feel like it's really affecting you? Is there a place that you can walk away to? Is there a caregiver or a nanny or helper in the home that you can say, you know, I need a break. I'm going away for 10 minutes and I will come back? Because it is really important to allow yourself that space to downregulate your own emotional response. And going back to things that parents do, and being a parent, I can say that I do it myself, so I'm speaking from experience, is that tunnel vision. When we notice the tantrum, there's something that happens to us where we think our child is the only one in the world tantruming. And so sometimes, especially if you're in a public place, you know, take a moment to look around and you'll find that many people are not looking at you with the judgmental stance that you might think that they are. So, mom, we're thinking about you, and I hope you get the help and support you need to help you.
Solidarity, sister.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, we've been talking about post-traumatic stress disorder this afternoon and how it, as many believe, it doesn't just affect those who've been into war. It can affect people who've perhaps been in accidents or witnessed crimes, traumatic births as well, we've talked mm-hmm. about. But what I wanted to ask was, what happens if it goes untreated?
Usually if it goes untreated, I don't want to say usually, but more often than not, people will find ways to self-medicate, so maladaptive coping. So this is where you have high rates of drinking and substance abuse associated with untreated post-traumatic stress disorder.
And what does treatment involve?
There's a number of different treatments that have some great evidence behind them. Cognitive behavioral therapy being one of them, CBT, and you can get trauma-focused CBT, acceptance and commitment therapy. Exposure therapy is also...
How would that work?
Exposure therapy?
Yeah.
Basically, you're working up to help someone experience that physiological response and understand and know that it's going to go away. And oftentimes with things like post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety disorders in general, people are afraid of what the body is doing. And so this is where things like CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy can help with restructuring and understanding what's going on in the body. No, your body isn't turning against you. It isn't, you know, you're not going to die. It's your body's response to a threat. And yes, that threat is not there. But how can we help you with breathing exercises, progressive muscle relaxation to ride the wave of that anxiety response?
There's
one more that I think is important to note. I almost listed them. I don't know what order I listed them in, but EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And so there's been a lot of research on that, which is a kind of technique along with re-experiencing where you are allowing the body to process the trauma in a different way.
I'm smiling because I had this a few weeks ago.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Relating to giving birth, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really interesting. It was Keith Littlewood and Al Coz who did this. And I'm from how you described it, he didn't name it as such, but that's exactly what we were doing to kind of address some pains that I've had that he feels are definitely linked emotionally to giving birth. So really, really fascinating. I'm joined by fantastic guests for news, views and more. This is Your Free Clinic for free advice, and I'm joined by Chastity O'Connell, who's mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Now, Chastity, we've been talking about post-traumatic stress disorder this afternoon, and we have had a message coming in that I would like to address. Regarding traumatic births, what about the later delayed effects that the trauma could have on the child? I had a very traumatic birth with my son. He has always had an underlying restlessness, is quite anxious, and emotions seem to bubble under the surface. Anything you can advise?
Sure. With traumatic births, oftentimes it impacts maybe those the quality of those early relationships. And so when we're thinking about it, this is where it's important to get intervention and help process through those traumatic births. At the same time, with traumatic births, there's this hypervigilance or hypersensitivity to what we see in the environment. And in fact, with traumatic births come an increased risk of postnatal depression, postnatal anxiety, as well as postnatal obsessive compulsive disorder about keeping that child safe. And so what I would also say is that children are born with an underlying temperament. And sometimes when you have a confluence of events, for example, the post-traumatic birth and a child with a more sensitive temperament, you know, we can start attributing causality to situations that aren't there. And so I would say at this point, it's just important to focus on if you think you can be there to the extent that you can for your child. And if not, then definitely reach out and get some help and support. There is, I just think that traumatic birth experience is so underreported and underrecognized, and I think it's amazing that there's time being devoted on today's show for that.
Talking about Brain Injury Awareness Month, now every 3 minutes in the UK someone is admitted to hospital with a brain injury, and almost 350,000 people a year in the UK admitted to hospital every year, with men more likely to be affected. We are, however, talking about one woman this afternoon. I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Vikas Farooqi, who's a consultant of physical medicine and rehabilitation at Amana Healthcare in Abu Dhabi. And Fatima Saleh Abdullah Omar is joining us too. Fatima's sister Reem was 21, was involved in a road traffic accident last June, which resulted in a severe head injury and multiple fractures. She spent 6 months in ICU and then was admitted to Amana Healthcare in December. Both, thank you so much for coming on this afternoon. We really appreciate your time. Now, Fatima, what can you tell us about Reem's accident?
We can start as it started in June, ending Ramadan. And it's a normal gathering. Usually people go to a friend's house to have suhoor, which is breakfast before the starting of fast. And coming back, she was with her fiancé at that time. And I guess due to the late hours, they were rushing to get home, to catch for Fajr prayers and stuff. And I guess that's where the rush, nighttime prayers, late to go home. So many things could happen. I can't put them in words. And tunnel was too small, too tight. Maybe he couldn't see it properly, and bam, we got a call around 2 a.m. Fajr prayer, so 4:30, saying my sister was in the hospital. So we thought like maybe it's something normal, you know, like she fell down, sprained her ankle with her friends dancing, whatever, it could be anything. I didn't know it was that serious. Then her friends called me where she had suhoor with, and told me that she's in ICU. I was like, ICU, how can she be in ICU? Just I remember like how many hours ago she was just telling me like, Fatima, I'm going to go to have suhoor with my friends and I'll be back. Then I was like, how ICU? I'm still driving to Sheikh Khalifa Hospital and putting my head, it's a sprained ankle. It's not ICU, it's a sprained ankle. Mom with me, because she's the first immediate parent. And I couldn't tell my dad anything. So I wanted to make sure. It's a sprained ankle or is it ICU? And there, I saw Reem in the emergency ward. Blood everywhere. It wasn't that night. It was the first time I would see Reem in that much pain, in that much, you can say, silence. It was traumatic for Mom, traumatic for me. Mom couldn't go in. I went in and I saw how the doctors were trying their best, were giving their best, because Reem just she took her first breath when I came in. And then that's where all the machines came and started their, their functions. The doctors were everywhere, nurses were everywhere. And all was well. I mean, alhamdulillah, she took her first breath. Then from there onwards, we thought like, khalas, and Reem is okay. She's going to be fine. She will be fine. And then it happened where, you know, we found out so many things, that she was in a car accident, and she was found outside the car. She was, because she didn't wear her seatbelt. And her fiancé died at the moment when he came out of the car. So many things that were unexplained, and even, you know, the footage was not clear enough to see like what happened, like all of a sudden. And you will think like one day you'll be smiling, happy with your friends or family or whoever, even going shopping, you forgot milk, then bam, you're in ICU.
Thank you for sharing the story. We really, really appreciate you coming in to talk about this. It's so important for a number of reasons, to raise that awareness about the brain injury, but also to talk about road safety as well. And as you said, he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and it's something we all need to be mindful of at all times. So you're in the hospital and you see her and she takes that breath. What were the doctors saying about her diagnosis at that time?
Since it was too early to predict or go through any, x-rays and all that, it really needed time to clear off, to have everything settled, her pulse, her rate, her everything, just to have it settled. The machine's doing its work, its job, its function. They didn't give me much to hope for, to be honest. They were very, it was a downer, you can say. They were like saying that we would not survive this. It's really lucky that she even got here to the hospital. She had several fractures, ribs, her pelvis, her right arm, especially in her brain, in her head, at that time. And we didn't even expect that she would take that breath. So she breathed now. She's breathing through the ventilator, but I would give it another 72 hours, that's what they say, and we'll see from there. For now, I can't give you anything. Her pupils are dilated, and that time I didn't know what that means. I was like, what does that mean? Why do you have to tell me this? I was like, Fatma, this is when a person is khalas, she's ready to go. I was like, no, it's not. Like, sometimes you go in water, it's dilated. It's the same thing. I was like, no, Fatma, this is different. Here is like, she's ready to go. And there was only one doctor who was very positive, you know, though he was giving me also bad news, but he was the only one which I saw was always updating me. He's the main physician at that time, and everyone was like saying like, there's no hope, there's no hope, there's no hope. But when he was there, he was like, no, there's hope. And that's when she took her first breath, because they were starting to remove all the equipments, like, you know, there's no hope, there's nothing, like, she's not giving me anything. As soon as Reem took that first breath, he was there. They just, like, you know, stabbed her with whatever there, just to keep, like, let the machine take over for a while, because she's giving the first, and then the machines will give it back. Like, I mean, it's like a two-way thing. So she's there. She's with us. So that was the first hope, yeah. And
it sounds like you really needed that, and it sounds like you learned a lot during this time.
Yeah, to be honest, I was very nervous. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know even what I'm doing was right. I hope that time I was doing right for me, my mom, my family. I hope I'm not acting out like I'm stressed or nervous or angry. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what was my situation, but I just hope whatever decision I'm making, whatever I'm signing at that time, it's the right thing.
Chastity O'Connell stayed with us. She's our mental health counsellor who works at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Dr. Vikas Faruqi is here, consultant of physical medicine and rehabilitation at Amana Healthcare Abu Dhabi. And Fatima Saleh Abdullah Omar is joining us. Now, Fatima's sister Reem was involved in a road accident last June, which resulted in a severe head injury and multiple fractures. And she spent 6 months in ICU before being admitted to Amana Healthcare. Now, Dr. Vikas, Reem was in ICU as a result of this road accident. What could she and couldn't she do when she came to you at Amana?
Thank you, Helen, for asking me to come here. Reem's story is an incredible story of survival, devotion, sacrifices, and basically both family and Reem were part of the treatment plan that we had to offer in rehabilitation. So she survived the accident, but that was one part of her recovery process. There was months and months of recovery left. So when Reem was admitted to Amana Rehabilitation Center, Rehabilitation Hospital, she was bedbound at that time. She had movement in her arms and legs, but she was not able to control those movements, so she could not even turn in bed herself. She was fully dependent for nurses to help her with personal care, and she was incontinent at that time. Her speech was dysarthric, and she was in quite significant pain. So basically, she was not able to perform any of her necessary life activities, and she had to be trained to learn those skills again.
So the brain injury that Reem sustained, how would you describe it in ways that we could understand? I know, Fatima, you must have learned a huge amount about medicine and treatment and brain injuries during the last year. But in a way that we could understand, what had Reem's body been through that had led her to this?
So brain injury is, you cannot categorize all brain injuries under one umbrella. So it is a spectrum of disturbances that happens, ranging from very mild injuries like concussions, which are getting a lot of attention from media because of many players are getting involved in it, which is good. And some of those things have brought up these events like brain injury awareness weeks. And to the other extreme, there are very severe injuries where most of the patients would die or who are surviving would not be able to interact with their environment in any meaningful way. So there's a whole spectrum of it. Reem's injury was on the severe side of the spectrum. When patients present to hospital, most of the other injuries get a lot of attention. So stabilizing her orthopedic injuries would be the focus, and managing her ventilation and airway. So the focus is to enable patient to survive the trauma. But then once the patients come out of coma and start interacting with physicians, nurses, or family members, then you are able to realize what the actual deficits are.
How long was Reem in a coma for, Doctor?
So Reem was in coma for 3 to 4 months, and after that she was in minimally responsive state, where her eyes were open, but she could not interact with the family. So she took almost 6 months to be ready to come into an intensive rehabilitation program.
And what, now, Fatima, you gave up your job. You're working at Etihad as actually the UAE's first female aircraft engineer, and resigned after 10 years of service to help take care of Reem. What was making that decision like?
Like, for when everything started, I thought I could handle work and going visiting Reem and everything, like trying to juggle. Then I see that most of the time I'm just worried. I'm worried. I'm at work, I'm worried. I'm in the bathroom, I'm worried. And there's so many things that I have to always keep myself updated, you know. If it wasn't me, then mom would forget or something. Because mom is mom. Mom's she's like just worried. She's just worried that is Reem going to be okay? Is Reem going to be doing what she used to do? Is Reem? So the more technical part where like the paperwork, the updates, the appointments, her next medication, at what time, all this is like, I have to keep track.
You are Miss Practical.
Yeah, I have to. So from the beginning I was there, I want to be in the middle, I want to be till the end. And that made me resign because I see myself giving, to be honest, like 20, even less than 20% at work, giving my best, but not as creative that I would like to be. I'm very creative. I like to give 100, even 200% at what I'm doing, especially in something I love. So in this case, I love Reem more. And I resigned after 10 years with Etihad Airways, yeah.
And what does caring for her look like for you on a very kind of basic level? How do you spend your days together?
From what, when we wake up, have breakfast, yeah.
Is she at home or is she...
No, right now she's still with Amana, yeah. Next week, she's super excited. She'll be back home, continuing also the rehab outpatient program. But other than that, with Reem, she's easy. For me, maybe, yeah, because I got used to it, where from ICU to a monitored ward, from monitored ward to Amana, and until now. So I guess for me, it's easy. People around me, they say like, oh, you're the superwoman, you're doing this. So I'm looking at it like, why are you telling me this? It's normal. I wake up with Reem, I eat breakfast with Reem, I go with Reem to the gym, I see what she's doing. She's silent sometimes, she's laughing sometimes. Tomorrow she wants Chris Brown to be played while she's in the gym. Oh, her favorite is Chris Brown, I swear. Chris Brown should like really come here and say hi to
a special
Reem.
Message for Reem. But yeah. I want to ask Dr. Fixer, it's been 2 months of really intensive therapy at Amana Healthcare. What has that therapy looked like?
So intensive neurorehabilitation involves many, many treatments that are given together by different clinicians who are experts in their field. So they built the skills again from zero level, and with the consolidation of the new skills, patients are able to do more. So it really starts with the strengthening and training how to move in bed to how to keep them sitting and how to transfer themselves from bed to chair. And this has to be done with the whole team. So it's not just one therapist who's going to deliver treatment and disappear. So the whole team has to continue performing the same set of activities throughout the day. And rehabilitation nurses form a big part of this recovery process. Every week we review how the patients are going and what new things they have learned and what should be the next step forward. And in between, we have to treat medical conditions that could facilitate the recovery process. So with Reem, pain was a significant issue, and muscle tightness called a spasticity that was problematic. So we had to provide treatment of that. Having said that, Reem is the center of this treatment, and it's her goals that we are working for, and family also. So they are all part of the treatment process.
And what goals have you as a family and with Reem put in place?
So the initial goals were about getting her sitting comfortably in chair and getting her able to be transferred easily, as easily as possible from bed to chair. And the other thing we started to work on first was to make her continent so that she's able to spend her days comfortably and be able to participate in therapy sessions.
March is Brain Injury Awareness Month, and each brain injury, as Dr. Vikas mentioned, is different. Defined as any damage to the brain that affects a person physically, emotionally or behaviourally. It can happen at birth or later in life caused by illness or trauma. Now we're going to listen to Olympic gold medalist rower James Cracknell, who was hit nearly 6 years ago by a fuel tanker that was driving at 70 miles an hour while he was cycling in America. Now here he is talking about how his brain injury impacted his relationship with his wife.
You're getting all the sympathy as the one who's had the accident, but the reality is it affects family a lot more. The impact on them is far greater because, especially for the first year or so, I was in my own happy bubble, and my behaviour was, you know, I was definitely different towards Bev. I was definitely different towards the kids. Much shorter fuse with them. So they had, especially our eldest, had one dad for you know 5-6 years, and a different one for after. And that's, you know, it's been really hard on him and our relationship, because things that didn't bother me before then bother me, and that takes time for him not to be able to understand that at his age it's difficult, and those bridges need to be healed, and only over time do you realise. And you know, it was only 6-7 months ago that when Bev was telling someone else about what it was like, or telling me, I couldn't believe she stuck with me. And I'm sure that's the case that so many couples split up because it is so difficult, and the way she explains it, and that it's easier to walk away, and that's where the support comes from.
There were times when I just thought, I can't be married to this man forever, because he was a different version of the man that I married. But there were also times, as I say, in the last couple of years, when I've just been so relieved that he's so much better. For me, one of the most important changes in a positive sense was becoming quite funny again. James had always had a fantastic sense of humour, and that was one of the things that I loved about him. But genuinely, for 5 years, he didn't get a joke.
Jokes aren't really good, though.
I think I was hilarious for 5 years. So I had no audience at home. But also, he'd completely lost his sense of humour, so he couldn't see the humour in anything, and gone from being very quick-witted and very sharp to not sharing the joke around the table, which was really hard. That was one of the things that I missed. I really, really missed that about him for a really long time.
That was Olympic rower James Cracknell and his wife talking about the impact on their relationship after his brain injury. Now, Dr. Vickers, I just wanted to ask you, Fatima saying that you're seeing these flashes of Reem now, this, you know, love of music and humour coming back. Brain injuries of a less severe extent than Reem, such as that James Cracknell sustained, can it impact a personality change?
Yes, so as I said, all the brain injuries are different from each other, so they impact on people in different ways. From personality-wise, it's a product of how their cognition, their behavior, and their emotional responses to stress change, and that changes a lot of things in personality. It's not unusual for people to not be able to remember past information or even new information. They are not able to concentrate on things, so that affects their ability to interact with people. They come up with headaches, nausea, dizziness, those sort of symptoms. And then their insight into a lot of things is impaired as well. So they may come up with inappropriate responses to conversation, or they may be emotionally labile or may be inappropriate when discussing topics.
I think that's an interesting point touching there on memory. How can Reem communicate now? How has that come on after the months of therapy?
You can ask her any question. She'll reply. Very straightforward. Humor, of course. Humor, I think it never left her. She was the first time she talked. There was no feelings, you know, and that didn't take that long, alhamdulillah. It took maybe weeks. It was just weeks, and she's back in being funny or just picking on you or something like that. You know, that's where it started. With Amana, it evolved. It became better. She knew how to express herself even more. She'll make up a story. She will give you excuses. And, you know, like, she's Reem, like how we used to remember her. But things that change was like attention span. It's shorter. She gets distracted very fast. If she remembers something, she will just out of nowhere bring it up. Even sometimes she wakes up in her nap and say like, oh, you know, remember when I wanted kunafa? You didn't bring it to me yesterday. I was like, okay, Reem.
So
napping.
She's back to picking on
yeah,
you.
Yeah, so yeah, this is the way she is. I like that now she knows what she wants to eat. Before she would eat anything. But now she knows and she wants what she wants.
That strength of personality is coming back.
Yeah.
And what about her memory? Can she remember things from before the accident? And what can she remember about that
Her memory is super sharp. She remembers everyone in high school, everyone in uni names everyone. I don't even know half of the people who comes and visit her. But 2017, it's a blank. For her, 2017 was, we went, because we spent New Year's in Athens, Greece, and Santorini. Wrong season, but we spent it. It was fun. But after that, she don't remember who we went with, but she remembered we traveled to Athens, and that's it. Then blank 2018. That's how Reem is right now.
And Dr. Bekas, do you think that memory will come back of the accident and have that time around it?
Well, you can't predict it. Again, with the severe injuries, you have retrograde amnesia, so you lose memory of the past events. They will have to come back on its own. You can't really do something to bring them back. Sometimes the experience of having those memories back might not be good, so she might relive the experience of trauma. So as long as she's not remembering, I think we are pretty happy with it.
Okay, now, Chastity, I'd like to bring you in here because we've been talking about post-traumatic stress disorder, and what I'd like to ask you about is the family of people getting support as well. You know, Fatima, you've given up your job. You're working really closely with Reem on a day-to-day basis and helping with her rehab and getting her back. But what support should families really seek out?
You mentioned the key word, which is support. And it sounds like in Reem's situation, there is a strong family support that's there. And part of that is to help with the psychological processing of what this means. Anything and everything from how do we make sense of this? Fatima, when you were saying, no, it can't be. It has to be a sprained ankle. It can't be ICU. It can't be ICU. And so there's this cognitive process of accepting what's going on, and that can take time. But then there's also the practical reality of who's going to be with Reem at the hospital, who's going to see to her getting the medications. And so you spoke so beautifully about, you know, there's so many different components that it's not just about the loss of, you know, Reem as we knew her, and what's in the uncertainty of what the fear of what's going to happen in the future. You mentioned your mom saying, I'm so worried, this just coping with that unrelenting uncertainty. And at the same time, the practical, okay, so I've seen Reem, you know, is she getting the movement in the bed that she needs to? What's going on? How do we stay on top of treatment? And we know that, yes, doctors, and it's wonderful hearing what you have to say, doctor. And at the same time, there's, you mentioned, you know, this element of advocacy of how much you're researching to find out, well, this is the latest treatment. This is what they're trying here. Can we try this? Is this going to work? So there's so much.
And as you say, kind of acting on behalf of her, you know, you're often her spokesperson and you're fighting that fight with her.
Yeah.
So you've got to be hugely strong. And you're saying what a strong character your mum is and how she's, you know, holding it together. But there surely must need to be some release and relief for you as a person, not just as a sister and a daughter. So I do hope that you've got someone that you can talk to who, you know, can let you blow off a little bit of steam and have a rant if you've had a bad day and those frustrations that must be inevitable with dealing with such a difficult situation. Mm-hmm. What you mentioned that Reem was at university. What were her plans? What was she studying?
Reem will be completing second year in nuclear engineering. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. She was having a hard time. So the only way to liven up sometimes when I say like, oh, Reem, you're not in university. You don't have to do calculus anymore. She really hates calculus so much. She even YouTubes every time she has an assignment, you know. I'm telling her, Reem, we can get a tutor, you know. It's like, yeah, so for what? So that if the teacher can't teach me, YouTube can. I was like, okay, yeah, it's
right,
as you.
2018.
Yeah, I swear. Yes. I swear everything is YouTube now.
So what does she want to do? What are her plans?
Right now, she was, before the accident, she was in like two minds. She found it was so hard, you know, going through calculus, engineering and everything. She was also trying to like, you know, maybe step down a little bit, go to mechanical, see how does that works for her first, and then major in whatever engineering fields that she wants to go through. But she was keen on nuclear Because it's new, I guess. That's the thing. The same thing with me. Aircraft was not my first choice. As what everyone say, you know, it's a man's world working with airplanes or cars or what. But yeah, so my sister is me. So she wants to be a nuclear engineer, then yeah, so be it.
I'm curious. Can I ask a question?
Of course you can.
What was your first choice?
Doctor.
Yes. What kind of medicine?
To be honest, anywhere in medical fields. Wow. Yeah, but it didn't work. It didn't work well so much because grades. I was getting good grades, but in a private school, lots of things happens in the middle, and I had to transfer to government. Mm-hmm. That's where it came down, because my Arabic is not that good.
Mm. Well, I don't think you should be embarrassed about being UAE's first female aircraft engineer.
Like,
Fatima.
No, like, subhanAllah, like, God has his plans, to be honest. This is how it looks like it, yeah.
Now, it's Brain Injury Awareness Month, and I'm joined in the studio this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell, Mental Health Counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, Dr. Vikas Farooqi, Consultant of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Amana Healthcare in Abu Dhabi, and Fatima Saleh Abdullah Omar has been talking about her sister Reem's accident last year, which resulted in severe head injury and multiple fractures. We've been hearing about Reem's rehabilitation at Amana, the personality coming back well and strong, and her plans for the future. Now, Dr. Vikas, she's coming home in the next couple of weeks. What's that transition going to be like for Reem as a patient?
So transitions with brain injury are always challenging, and we are mindful of that. One of the important things is that Reem is now recovering. Now, she has lost her autonomy after the accident, and now part of her rehabilitation was to make her independent and regain that autonomy in terms of planning for herself, decision-making, and those sort of things. And sometimes it gets difficult for families to step back and allow that space to the patients. But Reem's family have been doing really well, so we didn't have to struggle too much with that. In terms of going home, Reem is now able to transfer herself. Family understands how to do that. She's continent. She's able to express her emotions and her desires. So the biggest challenge was to have the appropriate place where she can get in and out of the home and would have enough space inside so that she could mobilize safely. So the biggest challenge was to find the right place to go to.
And what kind of facilities or features would that home look like? What does it need?
Practically before the accident, we used to live in an apartment in the city in Abu Dhabi, and knowing that Reem is gonna go home eventually and we need a bigger place, of course, we transferred near Amana Center in Khalifa City, and it's a bigger home, bigger space wise and every time I was looking for a house, it was never perfect. I always have to put in my head, the stairs are too much, the doors are too small, we need more space in Reem's room, Reem's bathroom needs to be more bigger, her stuff should really fit. And that's what we did. What's the best thing about Amana is, like, they really think about patient care in the hospital and outside. We even had one of the occupational therapists come with us to decide on the home.
That's fantastic, yeah, to have that professional eye.
And she came and she said all her her inputs, and I told her, like, I hope this is okay. It was like, the only thing right now is just the ramp, and that is, alhamdulillah, here we have, you know, companies that have portable ramps. We don't have to have one that is permanent, because either ways it's rented, so we can't, you know, destroy a lot of things of a rented home. So having a portable ramp is also practical, so Reem can go anywhere. I can bring that portable ramp anywhere with me, make it short, long. So in either ways, it's practical to have that ramp, yeah. Space-wise, all the commodities that she needs has been asked for or requested. And alhamdulillah, I think the transition with the, of course, ongoing outpatient program.
Yeah, how often will she be coming to see you, Dr. Vikas, seeing your colleagues at Amana Healthcare?
So unfortunately, we are not currently offering outpatient programs. So, but we have a home health rehabilitation team that can visit Reem and provide therapies. Reem is at a very important sort of juncture of her recovery, where she is now taking steps and attempting to walk. So it's really important to keep up the intensity. We will continue till family would find suitable outpatient rehab options for Reem. In terms of plan, she would probably need another 12 months of rehab as outpatient to recover to the maximum level of recovery. As long as she's recovering, we are hopeful that she will continue to recover, and we hope that she will be surprising us one day, visiting, walking, and on her own.
She will, I'm so sure. With heels.
I want to thank you, Fatima, for coming in this afternoon and sharing that story. And as I said earlier, it's so important on so many different levels, obviously touching on brain injuries, but also that road safety. I just wanted to give you that last word to say, if anybody's listening out there, what would you want to say to them about road safety and generally looking after each other on the roads?
I would say, like, if you're late, you're late. You don't have to rush. You don't have to be that place. If you're late, you're late. You'll reach either ways. If you're driving fast or slow, always be safe. Seatbelts, please. Seatbelt. And if it did happen, God forbid, do your research. That's the main thing. Do your research. Be hands-on. Because what Reem was going through is not common. And we don't have that facility that would accommodate every time, like a flu. You can just go and get a flu shot. No, this is a brain injury. This is not something that is. There's a book out there. It's a brain. Even doctors keep telling me the biggest doctors with PhD wouldn't know half of the knowledge of what a brain could do. You know, they would know only 20 to 30% of the brain. Do your research, check on them, and don't take it lightly. You know, the different brain injury is not whatever you read in Google. That's what I came to know. It's asking questions, is knowing, it's wanting to be in that person's life, even if they're going through such a trauma. Don't let them go, because you don't know. Maybe you're the one who's going to save them, not the doctors. Yeah.
Fatima, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Chastity O'Connell from Human Relations Institute and Clinic, and Dr. Vikas Varuki from Amana Healthcare. Thank you all.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcast at DubaiEye1038.com.